It's clear that I can't stay. Since I'm trying to kill some time, I think that I'm gonna try and find the medicine to cure the world.
Hi, this is Pirate Davy Jones with PiratePods.com. I'm here this morning with...
My name's Abel Mouton. I'm a singer, songwriter, and political activist that lives in San Francisco. I'm sitting down here in our beautiful China Basin neighborhood. And you can smell the canal.
Yeah.
You can see the biotech towers in different distance.
Aha. Uh-huh. Oh, well, I think that's a great opening. Could you tell us a little bit about the biotech industry there? What are your thoughts on that?
My thoughts on it? Well, I mean, to me, I first became aware of what was going on. There was a big bond measure, a statewide bond measure, and a big political fight about what town to situate the StealthSim research in here. And they decided to do it south of Market. So I first became aware of it, like, riding on the 15th Street line, which, like, snaked through this section of town that used to just have absolutely nothing in it, and now it has these towers that look like they could be in Blade Runner or something. So, I mean, in general, I'm not against stem cell research, or I'm not against any kind of technology, but like, the ultimate question is who controls the technology and to what end?
That's correct. I mean, I think that's a good point you bring up. I think a few years ago I read a Mother Jones article, something about the ability to create a chimera, and that would be, I don't want to say a subhuman, but that would be a being that would be partly human and perhaps partly animal.
Right.
In fact, there is the ability to create one of those things today, but now it's a matter of who would own that and just who can do that. And would you have any thoughts on that?
Well, I always think of, there's like this, in San Francisco we have a newspaper called the San Francisco Bay Guardian.
Right.
And the editor is a guy named Tim Redmond, who is a notorious cocaine addict. And I remember reading an article that he did talking about robots, like it was like when Roomba was starting to come out, and they're talking about stem cell research. And he wrote this long, well, it wasn't a long, it was an editorial piece about how, like, about what are the rights of robots going to be in the future society. And I thought it was really funny because Tim was clearly high when he wrote it. But then I started thinking about, you know, creating life forms to do the work that human beings don't want to do. It raises some ethical questions.
It does.
Are we creating a new race of slaves? Is that cool or not?
That's
my gut instinct is kind of no, it's not cool.
That's correct.
But I don't spend a lot of time thinking about it, honestly.
Oh. Well, I think I certainly started to think about it after I read that article. I mean, one of the questions that were raised was, you know, well, if you do create it, it runs along the same lines as what you mentioned. You know, do you consider these people human? Do you consider these beings human, these chimeras? And if you do the same rights that apply to all human beings in the United States, according to the Constitution, does it apply to them? And if that's so, why have they been created? You know, so that's right. It's you can come.
And even if they're not human, you don't have to be a human to have rights. I mean, dogs have rights in the United States.
That's right.
You know, they're not as severely protected, but, you know, just because the life is created by human beings, does that mean that the humans get to use it for whatever they want? I mean, the answer is probably, you know, in the physical realm, the answer is probably yes, but ethically, is it the right thing to do?
Right.
The whole thing feels really weird to me.
Yeah, it is
honestly.
Odd. Yeah. In many ways, I hope I don't have any problems with progress, but I hope to never see something like that, because
right.
All the implications that are we're just raising now just by talking about it, you know, the whole thought is a very scary thing. Okay, well, since
and
we're
what
this...
is the point? And what is the point at which the life form? You know, if you start talking about man-made life forms or some kind of combination of machines and biological material, at what point do they become sentient enough or conscious enough or whatever to deserve some form of rights? You know, because nobody's going to cruise around arguing for the rights of ATM machines to unionize, right?
Well, yeah, people are less likely to do that for human beings, right?
So there you have it.
Right.
There you have it.
Yeah. There we go. So, could you tell me, since we're on the subject of drugs, you mentioned cocaine. Could you tell me a little bit about the influence of Heroin Song?
Heroin Song. Well, we have a lot of arguments about Heroin Song and what it's actually about.
Right.
The way that it's spelled is it's actually heroin with an E.
Right.
Which what with gender. With the wholesale elimination of gender pronouns in the English language, I guess it's kind of a passe word at this point. There's just heroes. We're not male or female.
Right.
How did the song come about? I think I was having a discussion with my friend, the guy who actually recorded the most recent record. And he said, we have all kinds of silly discussions, but his position was that if you really wanted to have a hit song, you had to have a song that was about heroin. And then he has this endless list of examples of songs that he cites that are really about heroin. So kind of as a joke to him, I thought I would write a song that was about heroin. But then I ended up, I don't know, so I kind of, like, I really like music, you know, and heroin has been a pretty, pretty strong influence in all kinds of music for as long, you know, a lot of great musicians have been heroin addicts.
That's right.
From Don Coltrane to Kurt Cobain, and then there's some music that we just think about being heroin addicts, I don't know, to me, Leonard Cohen really gives me a heroin addict vibe, or Elliot Smith, I mean. Great heroin addict right there. Right. So my song kind of departed from like points of like a couple of like a guitar part that's not, I write everything on acoustic guitar. So it departed from the position of a guitar part that was kind of sounded like something Elliot Smith might do, plus like a little snatch of Suzanne by Leonard Cohen. And then I started writing this song about these guys that I know that are heroin addicts. They have this band. These heroin addict guys have this band. It's just like the most cynical band I've ever heard. They do like really silly songs, but all of the silly songs are extremely mean-spirited. So I thought I'd try their game, only make it about them and their lives. So there's like Marie who steals the wake up, but then the song starts to be more about my own life at a certain point because it's a song about sexual dependency, and chemical dependency is kind of a side note to all of that at the end of that.
I see. So it works on many levels, right? It's not necessarily about
you
one.
Know, it does to me. Sorry.
Oh no, that's fine. I think that's what, you know, listeners want to know. You know what in the hell did this guy mean when he wrote this song? You know, and often I say it's a misinterpretation, but I think sometimes people say, well, no, it's maybe just a reinterpretation when a listener hears something and decides, oh, yeah, I think this is what it's about, or you know, I can totally relate. He's talking about me, you know, or whatever. And perhaps
right.
You are, you know, but it's...
Well, Elvis Costello says that your response to a song or what you think a song is about tells you more about yourself than it does about the artist.
That's right. That's right. Okay.
Heroin Song is pretty fucking topical, though. In a way. like I wanted to write a song, you know, part of the joke of the song to me was to write a song that was a double entendre, but was like, it was so obvious what it was, you know, and also to have a part at the end where the guy's screaming for heroin, like Stinky and Hate Comics.
Great. Could you tell me a little bit about your political activism? Any plans to run for office in the near future?
No.
Okay.
No plans to run for office in the near future. I'm kind of on hiatus. Like, I got really involved in politics in the time leading up to the war in Iraq, and I ran for office 2 or 3 times for a community college board here in San Francisco, once for a public power board, but then the ballot measure to create the power board failed, so it wasn't created.
I see.
So, and then I kind of, like when the war started and started going, I got really super depressed and started to feel like I was wasting my time and got really, you know, like there wasn't much fun to it. There wasn't much joy in it.
So I
kind of moved away from it in the interest of looking for a way of approaching politics that would be more integrated with my day-to-day life.
I see.
That was when I started focusing a lot more on the music at that time. And I produced the records that I've produced so far. So now I'm starting to have more feeling like there's something that I can do, like there's a way that I could do politics that would combine my art and my politics, and I wouldn't feel like a sellout. I could be myself, and it would be fun.
I see.
There's some candidates that I liked in the last election. I really liked Todd Creation, from the Green Party, who's also a member of the International Socialist Organization.
Okay.
I really liked him. He ran for Senate against Dianne Feinstein. I helped organize a real small fundraiser for him to give a speech, and I was thinking of doing another one, but then it just kind of slipped away. It went too fast.
I see.
That was interesting to me. I might support another candidate, but I don't think I would run at this point. But it's only now, like, I guess it's been 4 years since I ran for office. It's only now that I'm starting to see, like, at the time it just felt like I lost.
Right.
It felt like nobody noticed, and it felt like I lost. But now I can kind of see better that we were building something, you know. And I couldn't see that at that time. The perspective was, I didn't have that perspective.
Sometimes it takes a few years to remove yourself from the situation, though, to realize what kind of an impact you had or might have had.
It's really, really hard to have that, like, to have subjectively the confidence to stand up for a position that's really, really unpopular. I mean, like, my politics are, like, way to the left of even most everybody in San Francisco. Like, I'm, like, the one guy in San Francisco who thinks Gavin Newsom is a right-wing piece of shit. You know?
Well, you know,
my politics are slightly to the left of Vladimir Lenin's. So it's really hard to have the confidence in that position to stand up for and also have the perspective that will allow you to keep going even when everybody is kind of making fun of you and laughing in your face.
Do you think that it's a part of even not just the U.S. culture, but even the San Franciscan culture, right, to really still fall within the realm of the two-party system and you know, kind of go with the flow of the rightward march, because it really, I think, for a number of years has been a march rightward. So even if you had considered yourself a liberal, God forbid, or a progressive, you know, that could mean something really bad.
Right. It does. Well, yeah, if you compare their platforms, you'll find that Bill Clinton was to the right of Richard Nixon on a lot of issues.
That's right.
Like, it's no joke, man.
So,
in San Francisco, we don't even have Republicans like they do in most other sections of the country. In San Francisco, Republicans are like third place behind Decline to State in the elections here. You know, we don't have general elections. We have primary elections for most statewide offices, mm-hmm. because the Democratic primary decides it.
I see. Ah, I see. Wow.
So.
So that.
So yeah, but I hate two-party politics. I just, it's like, it's really, really frustrating to me to see super smart, passionate people that, like, don't really believe in what the Democratic Party really stands for, what they really carry out in terms of, you know, what they really carry out programmatically. It's really tough to watch people just defend that you got to stay in that party, which basically supports the program of tax the hell out of the poor at home in order to bomb the hell out of the poor in other countries, you know?
Mm-hmm. Good. That said, though, do you think that something will change in the near future? In terms of
hard to say. Not with that attitude, man. Not with that attitude. That's what I say. You know, that's the loser attitude right there. You know?
Well,
I think Ralph Nader. If anything changes, people are really going to figure out that Ralph Nader was like this fucking voice out in the wilderness that was saying, telling people something really important.
Well, there are various theories on Ralph Nader as well, right? I mean, I think people also said that, oh, you know, and I think he was just placed there, and somebody, you know, he got a payola from the Republican Party to do that. I don't know if that's true or not.
I don't think that wouldn't stand up.
Yeah.
To serious scrutiny. That'd be basically a Democratic blogger's position. A two-party flat earth blogger.
Quite possibly, that's right. Well, tell me what your thoughts are on Ruth Gordon.
On who?
Ruth Gordon? Yes.
The actress?
That's correct.
Ruth Gordon? Oh! Oh my gosh, I'm a huge Ruth Gordon fan. I was like, wow, this guy's asking me about Ruth Gordon. Yeah, well, I mean, to me, her whole reputation is predicated on her excellent work in Harold and Maude and Rosemary's Baby. like those two movies, you know, like, I don't know, I found her kind of hot in those movies. I don't know what anybody else thought. I'm not somebody who generally gets, like, super excited about movie stars.
Right.
But Ruth Gordon in Harold and Maude and Rosemary's Baby, that's hot to me.
Oh, she was amazing. That's true. She was totally amazing. Yeah. Great.
I'm not that familiar with what she's done besides that. I assume she probably has, like, some huge theater background or maybe even a vaudeville kind of background. But
I think she's also written some books.
She's wrote books?
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
I didn't know that. She's dead now.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
Well, she's not writing too many books lately.
That was a loss. That's a loss for a lot of us, I think. Once she passed away, that was a loss. You know, kind of like losing Syd Barrett.
Syd Barrett, yes. Yeah, I'm a big fan of Syd Barrett, too.
Yeah, yeah. Great.
I really liked... For people who like Syd Barrett, I think a really good record to get is Robin Hitchcock's I album.
Oh, is that so? Why is that?
Yeah, it's like spelled EYE, like eyeball without the ball part. And yeah, that's I got that right about the same time I was getting into Syd Barrett. And it was recorded here in San Francisco on the Tenderloin, actually, that Robin Hitchcock record. And
No kidding.
It sounds like, compared to a lot of his stuff, it's like real deliberately angular and quirky. It has a lot of stuff that's really soft and pretty on it and has those super surrealistic kind of lyrics. And yeah, it's great. It's a great album.
Wow.
A couple of great songs. It's the best Robin Hitchcock record by far.
Oh, geez. Great.
In my opinion.
Well, I'll have to look for it. I can't say I have it. Can't say I have that one.
Yeah.
I'll certainly have to look for it. So what, musically, influence you?
As a musician?
That's correct.
Lots of stuff. I mean, like when we were kids, we had the Beatles records in the 70s. Those were really good. I used to listen to those a lot. I probably absorbed a lot of ideas about song structure, especially from the Beatles. Like that's, like to me, songwriting is always verse, chorus, middle eight, verse, chorus. Like that's the fundamental structure and everything departs from there. Like I realize now there's a lot of other stuff that you could do, but like at the core, like that's the form that I always fall back on whenever I get stuck. I'm looking for something that a song needs. It might be one of those things, structurally speaking.
Right on.
Later, I really liked, I remember I wasn't so much a punk rocker, like when punk came in, but I really thought a lot of the music that was inspired by punk and a lot of the music that was kind of expressing itself in the mainstream,
right,
was that it kind of had that sensibility that kind of went against the grain,
right?
I thought, or at least it seemed like it at the time. Now it was, I remember really liking Culture Club in eighth grade just because they freaked everybody out so much, but their music was really pretty. Culture Club.
Boy George and Culture Club. Really?
Yeah. Good. I remember thinking that. Yeah, I thought they were great. Just because their music was so mainstream that their presentation was so weird relative to what else was going on. I mean, now, with a sense of history, you can see that they're really just carrying some stuff over, and they weren't as wild as they seemed at the time, but they seemed really wild.
I think for the time it was. I mean, to have it was a male and made up, and I would say in lots of ways, Boy George was really in your face in a mainstream way.
Right, but like every pop singer that got really popular has been accused of being homosexual. Like it wasn't that far off from like Liberace. In retrospect, we can say it wasn't that different from, say, Liberace or, say, Little Richard, or, say, Elton John. Like, how different was it from what Elton John was doing? I think the pattern is actually very similar to what Elton John was doing in the 70s,
Right.
Clearly a very flamboyant homosexual man,
right.
But, not actually admitting that he was gay, even though he was pretty much hiding in plain sight. But to me, I thought the Smiths were ultimately a lot more daring in that respect. It really contributed a lot more to the vocabulary of pop music.
I see.
Way, I think the Smiths really, invigorated the idea of a romantic pop song. Because it was a dude singing about another dude, that it really made the romantic lyrics and the sense of alienation within the song. It gave it an extra gravity that didn't exist anywhere on earth anymore.
Very good. Hey, could you tell me about your small business background? I think at one time you're a business owner. If you aren't still.
I had a job running. I used to work in comics. Basically, I had an electronic prepress facility for superhero comic books.
Was that so?
I really liked comic books as a teenager, and I got a job as a comic book colorist. And when computers came in, I was one of the first guys to ever start doing computer color and computer color separation for comics, which is how everything is done now. I started a business. The shop that I worked on and the shop that I trained in and eventually ran was called Ole Optics, and we did a lot of your favorite comic books.
Oh, wow.
From like the late earlys and early 90s. We had a really long run on a Batman title called Legends of the Dark Knight.
Wow.
Which was sort of more, it was kind of in between the prestige format titles and the newsprint titles.
Wow.
It's like more boutique kind of creators doing alternative takes on Batman, and we provided high-end color for that. We colored. The first book, computer separated in the United States, was a book called Akira.
Huh.
It was the English language translation of the Japanese Akira comics.
Oh, I see.
So we did that. And we did Spawn. That was the other big famous title that we had. We did the first, I don't know, 30 issues of Spawn or something, and I worked there for 18. And then when I left that shop, I started working for Eric Larson, and I started my own company to do that. We were able to operate for about 6 years, I think.
Jeez.
Doing the Savage Dragon. Yeah. The Dragon and a bunch of other crap, like Vampirella. There's some really fucking terrible comics, but the Dragon I thought was always pretty cool. The Dragon really informs. Like those Image guys, you know, with the concept of artist ownership, you know, by applying the concept of artist ownership to mainstream superhero comics, that was like a big influence on me. You know, especially Eric's stuff, because he was the one guy out of them all that really, really wanted to just do comics, you know? And really wanted the freedom to do cool comics. And that was his chief concern. I don't know how well it's working out for him now, because who wants comics with video games and the internet and movies being so exciting? I mean, comics are mostly a ground for developing property for movies, which go directly to DVD and turn into video games.
Yeah. That takes time, though. I mean, that on top of that, I mean, it really does take.
The nut behind the wheel who creates the idea, like, is so far removed from the final product and has to do it in such a vacuum, you know, financially speaking. I mean, I think Eric does pretty well now. Eric did pretty well off those first Dragon issues, and he was really smart with his money. So, you know, he's looking pretty good for doing his comic.
Great.
For the rest of his life, which is what he really wants to do.
Yeah.
I don't think comics are going to be... Comics are not a particularly exciting medium to me now.
All right, great. Thanks for sharing that with us. And which directions do you think your music will take in the near future? Do you have any ideas, any plans to break from what you currently do with that? Is there do you have something up your sleeve, or... Or do you think every day is that?
I mean, I'm not really holding my breath, you know, for superstardom. You know, I feel like I'm kind of getting on a higher level with my playing technically. Like, I'm really, really confident in my writing at this point, but like my playing has always been a little bit of a sticking point for me. So I'm feeling really confident with my playing right now. And I haven't been focusing on writing so much. I've been trying to get more skills at, you know, booking shows and you know, performing, you know, having an organization that can actually play the music really loud and kick ass over other bands. So that's been kind of an exciting development, that there's more of a permanent band developing now. I got working with a couple of guys, a guy named Michael Mullen. He's a great writer. He has a group called Pocket Shelley. He's a great writer, great keyboard player, great, very creative guy. And he has his own, did I already say Pocket Shelley? He has his own thing called Pocket Shelley. I've been working with him. And then there's another multi-instrumentalist guy named Matt Sealing. He used to be in a band here in town called Angels Camp. So the three of us have been working together pretty seriously. And making a pretty solid group. I've been really inspired by the band. There's a great book out called Across the Great Divide, which is a history of the band.
Oh, the band?
The band called The Band.
Right.
Which I highly recommend. It's a great book, you know, for anyone who wants an overview of, you know, music history in the United States. It's a pretty essential book, Across the Great Divide by Barney Hoskins. And I've really been inspired by the way that they worked lately. So the record I just did has like a lot of, you know, the idea was I was kind of under the influence of a lot of people who are like really gung-ho about rock, like, oh yeah, rock is good. If music is good, if it rocks, and if it doesn't rock, then it's not good. So like I was like, oh well, I'm gonna make some music that rocks just to demonstrate to everybody that I am the rockingest one. And so I went out and I made the record, and, you know, it definitely rocks. I will say that Singled Out is definitely a rock record. But, like, now I listen to it and I kind of, like, a little bit like, wow, what was I thinking? So I think, you know, I think you get a, I think I'm leaning more towards doing stuff that has softer sounds. It's not, that's not, you know, trying to be so balls to the wall in your face. This is the music. Listen to it because there's nothing else for you to do. So I'm trying to do some music that's a little bit more self-assured in that sense and has more confidence, you know, has softer sounds, I think. Will be what we're leaning towards. Also, I'm really, really, you know, for future recordings, I'm pretty burnt on, like, the super Pro Tools eye sound. I'm super burnt on the everybody has a computer in their room, super layered up, highly edited, processed tracks. Like, you know, computers are really cool for democratizing things and giving more people access to technology.
That's correct, yeah.
But it's kind of a bummer in the sense that it makes everything sound the same. But, like, the records that I get really excited about are records that sound like Burt Bacharach's, you know, Dionne Warwick records from the 60s and 70s that are all recorded live.
I see.
The Bob Dylan records that he recorded, like, 66. Those, you know, that where everybody, it just sounds like everybody playing together. And I think that that's a sound that I would like to hear more of and I would like to produce.
Right.
So those are some general ideas. I think, like, thematically, the music is going to be a little more introspective and hopefully a little more, but a little brighter, emotionally speaking, too.
So which was your last album purchase? What did you buy last, if at all?
What did I buy last? I think I was inspired to go out and buy the first two band records. I got those.
Huh?
I think I got a copy of Dark Side of the Moon. Or no, not Dark Side of the Moon, Wish You Were Here, because I was trying to impress this girl. I don't really like Pink Floyd all that much. I think those band records are the most recent purchases for me.
Great.
Mostly, I don't know music is good until it's old. Like, I'm really, really susceptible to peer pressure. So, if I usually wait to reserve judgment on it until after people don't like it anymore, and then, like just last year, I'm like, wow, Nirvana's really great. did I know they were great at the time? No. In 1990, I got my first Smiths record, and I was so excited. They were so great. I could have gone to see the Smiths in 1986, but did I want to? No. Everybody else liked them.
Right.
So,
hey, could you tell me a little bit about Cannot Escape?
Cannot Escape. Yeah. What about it?
Well, what was this about? I was guessing on this one, so I don't know. What is it about to you?
What is it about to me? Well, Cannot Escape kind of fits in a four-part sort of song cycle that includes a number of other tunes, but it's kind of, you know, it's kind of about the point in a relationship where, like, you know, I mean, if you're the kind of person who really likes people who sometimes don't like you back, it's kind of about it's kind of about getting from the point of the relationship where I'm just devastated over the fact that this person doesn't want me the way that I want them, and finally developing some perspective about it by the end of it, by, you know, experiencing love as a more metaphysical kind of force rather than something that has to be reflected in reality at all times.
I see.
That's kind of the point of the song. I don't know how clear it is because there's layers of obfuscation, but the clue to figuring out what it's all about is understanding that the voice of whoever's speaking at the end is different from the voice of whoever's speaking beginning.
So to my father I did appeal. This mortal wound, will it never heal? I've stolen everything that I could steal. Nothing eases the pain I feel. And an answer came, a reason for being as clear as my name. And an answer came, my reason for being all one.
Also, originally, I really like those super long Hank Williams Sr. song titles. So it was originally called You Cannot Escape My Love for You. Like a Hank Williams tune.
Hey, very good. See, that's something that's something I wouldn't have guessed. Not at all. That's the beauty of these things, you know, to see what's going on in one's mind. Excellent. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
How was the recent Flaming Lips show over there?
The Flaming Lips show? Oh, it was great. I mean, yeah. Well, Gnarls Barkley opened, and I hadn't really heard them too much.
Right.
Once they played Crazy, I was like, oh, it's the guys who play that song. Because you hear it just, you know, in shopping malls and stuff. But I thought they were really good. They put on a great show. They were all wearing like these 1950s astronaut costumes, and then the uniforms. And then the Gnarls Barkley dudes come out and they're wearing like full on space suits. They walked out to the Thus Spake Zarathustra from 2001, and took off their space suits and did Space Oddity.
Oh wow!
Yeah, that was pretty cool. And then they did their whole set dressed up, you know, and they had all these great choreographed dance moves and stuff, like a string section, a four-piece string section, all hot women in miniskirts doing these choreographed dance moves. It was pretty surrealistic. And then the Flaming Lips, like, I don't know, I never saw, like, a rock band of that stature that, like, it was at Bill Graham Civic, which is a pretty good-sized venue here in town. It's one of the larger venues that's actually in San Francisco. And the Flaming Lips actually came out and helped set up their stage. Like,
that's
when
right.
Do you see that? Like, I almost never see that. And they're already kind of, you know, their crew is all dressed up in superhero costumes. And
that's
they come out and they're already messing with the audience and while they set stuff up. And it's, you know, it already has a really trippy vibe even before they play a single note.
That's
and then, like, the whole lighting rig turned into a flying saucer that descended to the stage.
Isn't that great?
The Flaming Lips all came out and they cut loose with all these balloons. Like, you couldn't even see the stage. There were so many giant balloons being bounced around the audience. it was really, like, I was totally sober at this event, but it was like being on acid. I actually replicated the experience of being on acid. And they, you know, they're from an entire different generation of rock musician. Like, nowadays, it's just, oh, yeah, I have jeans and a T-shirt, and my music is so great that you're just going to love it. But they're like, they understand that it's important to, you know, descend the stage in a flying saucer and have Santa Claus and a bunch of superheroes dancing around on stage with you and, you know, have a really trippy light show.
Right.
You know, on top of having great songs and have the music sound great. Like, just really, really great sounds on stage.
I agree. I totally agree.
And the fucking camera that's mounted on Wayne's microphone, so you can see the whole show from the perspective of his microphone projected on a giant screen. You can actually see inside of his mouth while he's singing. That's very funny to me.
Yeah, absolutely. I think their shows are amazing as well.
Yeah.
Hey, you know, it's great talking to you, Abel. If you could, you could do us a favor. I ask each person that I interview to do their best pirate impression. So if you can do that, it'd be great.
My best pirate impersonation?
Yeah.
What, do you want me to, like, stab a passerby and take their money? I don't know, man. I'm not so sure about this whole piracy thing.
Well, give us your best pirate arc.
How about if I tell you a pirate joke?
Okay, that's good. I like that.
Would that work?
Sure, absolutely.
Okay, so there's this pirate captain, and they've just gotten done with a big fight, and the pirate says to the captain, he says, "How come you always wear that red shirt?" He says, "Well, I wear it to build morale, because that way, if I get cut or I get hurt during the fight, nobody can see the blood that's building up on my shirt. So they'll think that I'll still be fighting as strong as ever. Nobody will know that I'm wounded. It's good for the morale of the crew when we're in a fight for me to wear a red shirt." And everybody's like, "Wow, that's really cool. That's good thinking. It really works." So the pirate captain is, you know, they go about doing their pirate thing or whatever. Mm-hmm. All of a sudden they notice, holy cow, there's a huge British warship coming their way. And they're like, "Oh my God, we better turn around." And they look back, and there's another huge British warship right behind them. British warship's coming from every direction. Pirate captain says, "Fetch me brown pants."
Very good, Abel.
Feel free to share that with your friends.
There we have it. That was Abel Mouton in San Francisco with Abel Mouton and the Tastemakers. It was a real pleasure dealing with you, and best of luck on your next endeavors.
No problem.
Hey, thank you so much, Abel. Totally appreciate it. Once again, this is Davey with PiratePods.com.
You got it harder 'cause you're smart.